Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast is being brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit coderedroofers.com.
I just don't understand how there could be such a tremendous gulf between the haves and the have-nots still, with all the information that's available to us. And instead of Congress and the White House, not for nothing, but telling 156,000 people that their student loans are forgiven, it doesn't seem to me like even getting close to the seriousness of student debt, nor does it seem to be anywhere close to making a way for young people to buy homes and to be able to pay their rent without having to live, you know, seven people to an apartment. I mean, do they not understand that that's what we're going through? And when I say we, look, obviously, I'm in a good moment in my life, and I'm not struggling right now. But I have kids and grandkids that are, and they're working hard. They're not lazy. They're not on any kind of assistance. You know, I keep begging my stepdaughter to just go get some food stamps. You know, you're entitled. She works her butt off. And she's struggling. Her rent is like $2,000 a month. I can't even wrap my mind around that. Okay? And it's impossible for her to buy unless, you know... She doesn't want a cosigner because I've offered. She wants to do it herself, and they just make it impossible for her. And it's so frustrating to be sitting here day after day reporting on how they don't seem to really care. They certainly don't care that I have a southern border that's wide open and that people are streaming across that border, people from all different nations. And they get more benefits than my family does. That is very aggravating to everybody. And yet, it doesn't seem to even occur to them that it may cost them, either side, in their elections. I mean, who's going to vote for anybody who's not going to give them some relief? It's all about the pocketbook. We know that. Do you think really people vote based on whether there are white nationalists protesting in Florida? It's an interesting story, okay. But people vote based on the nothing but cereal and white bread in the shopping cart. That's what they vote on, if they vote. They're so disillusioned that they may not even vote. So many people talking about these things, and The Congress is detached. Do you realize that half of the college graduates in America today are working jobs that do not use their degrees? Think about that. So we're forgiving loans for degrees that have turned out to be useless. That doesn't seem like a logical good move. Bachelor degree holders in college-level jobs earn nearly 90% more than people with just a high school diploma in their 20s, but underemployed college graduates earn 25%, only 25% more than high school graduates, not 90%. So in 1 year, we've seen this tremendous drop in the value of a degree. It's just not worth it. And if it's not worth it, then why are we loaning money to people to get them? And then why are we put in the position where we have to forgive the loans? Look, I come from a family where Mine was the first generation to go to college, never mind to graduate and go to graduate school. All right. And then the next generation, my children, you know, got to go to college and grad school and have great professions, blah, blah, blah. But at what cost? You have to become either a high-powered attorney or a specialist in some sort of medical practice. Or what are you doing? A degree in education, which I had. A degree in psychology. I have psychiatric social work. What kind of job can you get? You can get a job, you know, selling timeshares. You can get a job in retail. You know, maybe I could be a manager in a food, in a fast food restaurant. It's crazy. We should be encouraging young people to take some time off after high school and start thinking about what you might like to do and stop worrying about the college degree. Because if you take an entry-level sales job right now out of high school, by the time you would have received your degree 3-4 years later, you'll probably have gone up the ladder. And you'll now be managing instead of laboring.
All these crazy alien stories can't be true, can they? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
I want Congress, I want the president to either get busy fixing these things or get the hell out of the way. I really mean that. Let the states handle it. And if you don't like the way your state is handling it, move to another state. You know, this idea that the federal government sitting in Washington, D.C., which is like la-la land. I mean, L.A. is bad enough, but D.C. is crazy. I mean, they're so detached from reality, it's not even funny. And they're making decisions about everything. The founding fathers wanted there to be multiple laboratories. That's what the states were. And they could each try out various things. Now, obviously, you need to have some federal legislation. You want a road system that works. You want a military that works. That would end up being a national issue. And so would immigration, except that we are now proving that doesn't work either. States are doing a better job. Look at Greg Abbott, okay? But if they can't get anything done, then why do we pay them $200,000 a year to go up there? I can't rationalize it anymore. And not only do we pay them $200,000 a year, each congressman, and $260,000 for the 100 senators, not only do we pay them all that money, we staff their offices. We have high-priced real estate in D.C. that they get to, you know, operate out of. And they are not expected to get anything done. I'd like to explain to the owner of Hubbard Radio, hey, look, you know, just pay me. If I can get anything done, that'd be nice. You know, I might show up and do a show every now and again, but don't count on me being there every day. And even if I am there, don't count on it being entertaining or getting ratings or anything. Can you imagine how long I would last with any of my employers? 34 years in August on the air in this market. At no point in time have I ever been fired. Well, I should take that back. Have I been fired for not doing my job? You know, and that's a direct result of knowing what's required in the position that I have acquired. Washington is malfunctioning because apparently they don't know what the job entails. See, the job does not entail putting a lapel pin on and getting upgraded to first class when you fly home to your district, if you even still do that. How many of these congressmen, really their residents now and their families are living in D.C. and they keep an address in their district just because they have to? But they don't know what's going on in their district. I can't tell you. There was a congressman, Robert Wexler, for years, nobody ever saw him down here. And you could tell he was so deeply embedded in Washington that when he gave up Congress, he became like the head of a huge agency, USAID, because he was a political animal. This is not working. And it's not the fault of the Constitution. It's not the fault of the founding fathers and the documents. It's not their fault. It's our fault. We accept this crap. I assure you that Clear Channel wouldn't accept it. Hubbard wouldn't accept it. Any of the companies I ever worked for would have accepted me saying like, well, I'll show up when I feel like it and I'll do what I feel like doing. They had very specific job descriptions. Get on the air when you're supposed to. Don't say any of these nasty words. And entertain the audience enough so that they stick around when you go off the air and listen to the next show, and enough that they come back the next day. It'd be nice if you get ratings, but, you know, we're more concerned with retention of an audience. So I said, okay, I know what I got to do. You know, I have to devote myself to being informed and entertaining. The minute I stop doing that, trust me, there'll be no love lost. They'll just tell me to pack it up. And here, I don't even have to pack it up now. You know, all I got to do is send back the equipment. It's crazy. And I got Congress people who don't do squat and make $200, $250, all that kind of money. It's time to take the country back. And if it means, you know, term limits, then that's what it means. I've always said, no, term limits, we have elections. If they're not doing their job, fire them. Don't vote for them again. It's not working. We need term limits. They don't get the job done, get rid of them. Give somebody else a chance. I know people who run businesses in Broward County who would do a better job than Jared Moskowitz as my congressman. End of story. That's all. All right, let me take a quick break. I'm obviously not, you know, I'm not feeling the love today. I'm full of antipathy and rage towards the federal government. So if that disturbs you, tough. Yes, yes, they were there. When we were chilling out, they were there. And I'm appreciative. Unfortunately, I do have a name to add to our list of the fallen. The Department of Defense announced the death of one sailor who was supporting operations in the Red Sea. Aviation machinist mate second class Oriola Michael Aragbasola, age 34, of Miramar, Florida. So one of our own, one of our Florida families has been affected. It's a result, apparently, of a non-combat related incident. He was assigned to the USS Mason, which has been deployed to the U.S. 5th Fleet Area of Operations as part of the Dwight D. Eisenhower Carrier Strike Group. So we'll know more as the days go by. But it's always basically a job with the possibility of a disaster occurring. It doesn't always happen on the battlefield either. It happens when they are in the process of training. It happens when, I mean, there's just so many incidents that have happened in the last couple of years where I say to myself, as if it weren't frightening enough for families to have to deal with impending war and people being in battlefields, now they have to worry all the time, are these helicopters safe? Are they able to navigate? I mean, for someone who is in the Navy, with everything that's going on in the Red Sea right now, you'd have to be more nervous than usual. But I'm just so grateful. I'm grateful for all of these families. I'm grateful for the men and women who not only serve in the military, but who are first responders and who serve in the police forces around the country, who serve as fire rescue personnel. It's just amazing how much sacrifice people have put their lives on the line for the rest of us. And in the meantime, you know, we're having discussions or we're watching a bunch of dudes on stage at a rally to raise $25 million for a campaign. And all I keep thinking to myself is, what's wrong with this picture? And then I have to let it go. You know, these glitzy fundraisers, they're probably going to increase as the months go by and we approach November. But it is, it's just so unfair. That's the only thing I can say. That we have people who are struggling, can't figure out how they're going to keep their families fed or even housed anymore. And you can throw a $25 million fundraiser with Joe Biden, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama. It's amazing to me. But the stock market is, you know, is surging. This was a great year already, the first couple of months. You had 22 record highs in 3 months. You have the key inflation gauge kind of hovering above the Fed target. But I was reading some interesting articles, and I'm digging a little deeper into this, about how COVID basically changed everything. It changed the way we learn. It changed the way we interact with one another. It changed, apparently, it changed the way we spend our money, which is amazing to me because not much will do that, but it did. And I was reading this article. I think it was it in the Wall Street Journal? It might have been, or in, it was in the Washington Post. That's where it was. And I don't read the Washington Post per se, but the article was reprinted on one of the search engines. Might have been Microsoft or one of them. And the 28-year-old person that they featured in this article hadn't traveled much before the pandemic, but this 28-year-old writer now travels whenever possible. If she hears about a concert and it's somebody she wants to see, she gets on a plane and goes. She's going to Atlanta to see Beyonce. She's going to Chicago to see Usher. She's doing girls' trips to Jamaica and Mexico. And whatever tour dates people announce, she starts rallying her friends and buying up tickets and flights and hotel rooms. She said, "My mindset has completely changed after COVID. When I see something I want to do, I make it happen." So I was thinking about that. You know, what have I how have I changed? And I must admit, there was a resonance with me when I read that. I don't hesitate as much anymore about spending money on important things. That doesn't mean I've become more frivolous, and I don't have that much money that I can just jump on a plane like she can to go see and buy a $1,000 ticket to see Usher in Chicago. I mean, that's not in my it's not in my plans. However, when I'm given an opportunity to go somewhere and it fits into my budget, or somebody's picking up the ticket, like you know, my daughter wants to take me to Puerto Rico and pay for all my expenses, I say yes. You know, we want to go check on Papa, see if he's doing all right. It's been months since I was there. And so I don't hesitate the way I used to. I don't do a whole lot of considering because I don't know how long we're going to even be able to travel. I think about how everything shut down. So now when I have an opportunity to go out to dinner, I'm not a person who even likes to eat out. But I go because I really, really didn't like being told I couldn't. I was getting things delivered. I'm not that kind of person. I don't like somebody coming to my door with a bag of food. I feel, you know, lazy when I see other people. I mean, obviously, if you're a senior citizen and you're getting meals on wheels, that's one thing. But I watch like my kids. They think nothing of ordering Thai food, which is then delivered to them by Grubhub or Uber or whatever, and it's as normal to them as, I guess, heating up a TV dinner used to be in the 50s and 60s when they came into being. I think back to those things. Nobody eats TV dinners now, I don't think. I mean, I think they still exist. I don't know. I walk down that frozen aisle very seldom. Only reason I even go down a frozen aisle is from, you know, if Breyer's on sale, buy one, get one. But, and I do buy frozen vegetables occasionally because things are out of season. But I was remembering the very first time. And we were kind of poor when I was growing up, so believe me, there was no frivolous dining, not at home or anywhere else. But I remember the first time my father went shopping at the A&P and brought home these two or three TV dinners. And I was like beside myself. It was like the coolest thing I ever saw. It came in a little package and, you know, tin foil covered metal serving platter. I don't even remember what it was. I'm sure it was disgusting. But it seemed like a very big deal to me. It was modern. And we didn't do a lot of modern things. We didn't even have a refrigerator, like in the normal sense of a refrigerator, when I was little. And sometimes when I say this, like my daughter and even, you know, my son and definitely my grandchildren look at me like that couldn't possibly be true. But we still had an ice box when I was very little, meaning that there was like ice in the bottom of this container and that cooled the things that were above it. And we had ice delivered. Our milk was delivered in glass bottles. And I think now Grubhub comes. You don't have to keep anything. You certainly don't buy TV dinners, or I don't know, maybe people still do eat that. I know they got the like the lean cuisine kind of things that single people still probably keep in their freezers. But things happen so quickly, change so quickly. But after that crisis of a pandemic, I think a lot of us change the way we spend our money and change the way we look at what are we going to do? What are we going to allow ourselves to do? Because the government made us stop doing everything. We were starved for human interaction, for socializing, for travel. So now people are spending money on those things because they missed them. A lot of people have stopped saving. I was reading another article on Fortune about the, well, this goes in periods. You know, this is sometimes there's good saving, a lot of saving, and sometimes there's very little saving. But right now, I'm reading all these financial advisors, and I should probably bring on Bob Rubin next week and talk about this. But clients are generally saving less than they were before the pandemic. People are planning maybe for retirement, but everybody's trying to, like, live. And they've made more room in their lives for concerts and travel and fun. People already had this attitude that you only live once, and now it's on steroids. COVID was a big wake-up call that life is precious and that you've got to enjoy it as much as you can. I mean, obviously, most people can't afford to buy a ticket to an Usher concert in Chicago, but if you can go to a concert in, you know, Miami or in Orlando that maybe in the past you would have hesitated to, I don't think you're hesitating anymore. I just had to talk about that briefly because I've been reading a lot about how we've changed post-COVID. And I think there's a lot of change. And I think it gets normalized so quickly. It's not like in the old days where things trended and then they changed slowly. And then you got more used to it, and then you looked back 10 years later and you understood what happened. That's not how we live anymore. It's like everything is accelerated. It's always quick. So we'll see, but I'm going to start looking more seriously at how some of these habits have changed. Certainly saving. Certainly people are spending money that they don't have. I look at the credit card debt that they're talking about. It's gone up 22% since the pandemic. And a lot of people are back to buy now, pay later. Now, there was a period of time where nobody did that. Like when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, you maybe did layaway, but nobody bought stuff that they didn't pay for until the future. And now people are back to buying on credit. And if you look at some of these figures, I think the Bank of America cardholders spent 7% more on travel and entertainment last year than they did in 2022, and especially on like big things, European vacations and cruises, with money they didn't have. That's pretty scary because it will catch up to us. Meanwhile, I think the name of the company is Live Nation. That's the owner, the parent company of Ticketmaster. They just posted a record $23 billion in sales last year and expects this year to be even bigger. Now, granted, they needed to make up for 2 years where nothing was happening. But wow, that's a lot of increase. $23 billion in sales to just go see concerts and stuff, especially when now you can just watch it on TV. Not just the concerts, but like how the concert was made. My husband is obsessed with watching, like, how were the Bee Gees created? He was watching yesterday, like, really? I don't care. Anyway, he does. Don't forget to download the app, the 850 WFTL app, on your cell phone or on your laptop. That's the way you can access all the podcasts and all the contests. We're giving away a 4-pack to Sunfest, and it's easier to do it if you have the app to enter the contest. But if you don't want to get an app, and I know a lot of people have just held off on getting apps, then just go visit our website, 850WFTL.com. Let me take a quick break. Derek will not be joining us today. Apparently, my son is on an airplane heading back from Tahoe. Now, must be nice. That's all I can say. I'll be right back. Now, I make fun of all the headlines, but now this headline captured my eye and it made me feel pretty good. It said that in the world's 10 most populous countries, 8 of them have leaders in their 70s and 80s. And then it said that 70 is the new 50. I like that. You know, obviously I would like that. Xi Jinping is 69 years old. Putin has been, you know, in power for 25 years. So he's in his 70s, right? We have India's Narendra Modi is 73, and everybody says it absolutely will get a third term at 73. Sheikh Hasina is 76. He's the prime minister of Bangladesh. He just won a fifth term. And let's see, of course, he shut down all of his opposition, threw them all in jail. That's kind of like the Putin theory, too. You just get rid of your opposition, you could stay there till you're 90. Let's see. Indonesia catapulted a 72-year-old member of the political elite to the top job. He's set to succeed President Joko Widodo, the former furniture maker and small city mayor, who won his election in 2014 when he was 53. So apparently across the whole world, nobody wants younger leaders. In America, we have to ask ourselves, how old is too old? We have two guys running who are late 70s, early 80s. Mitch McConnell finally stepped down from a leadership position at 82. I think Nancy Pelosi is 140. I don't know. She's very old. And I haven't heard anything about her stepping out of the political arena at all. Has anybody? No, because she's not going to do it. She'll be like, what was her name? Dianne Feinstein. Just if they'll wheel her in and they'll take her hand and push the button when they have to vote. It's really kind of sad that there's no afterlife for politicians. One would hope that after you serve your country for decades, these people have been, except for Donald Trump, they've all been serving for decades. Joe Biden's been in Congress, the Senate, and the White House for four decades. There's nothing he'd rather do for the rest of his life? I find that extremely sad. I'm one of these people who wish I could just go. You know, I can think of 100 things I could do every week if I didn't work, including things that might look like work to other people, but to me would be incredibly rewarding: volunteer work, reading, writing the book, all that stuff. Really, there is nothing Mitch McConnell can think of that would have been better than spending his 70s and 80s flying back and forth from Kentucky to Washington, D.C., to basically be pilloried by the media and be insulted by members of his own party and hated by members of the opposition party. Really? That's the best they could do in their 70s? At least we could say, for Donald Trump, this is a late-in-life new career. And he's also got incredibly thick skin and apparently could care less what the majority of the mainstream, whether it's the media or the political class, what they think of him. Doesn't care. And many people say he doesn't really care what we think about him. But I don't believe that's true. I'm just saying. And I found out this morning, my friend Lou Dobbs is coming to speak at Club 47 in March. And, of course, I intend to be there. Lou and I have tons of history. But I know that for someone like Lou Dobbs and someone like me, we allowed our careers to wind down. We may have always had presence, but we didn't work as hard as the 40 and 50-year-old guys did. Like, this is Jesse Waters' time, not really Sean Hannity's time. Although Sean's younger than me, but I don't understand how you could make all that money and have all that fame and not be able to think of something you would rather do. Really? I mean, I'm not that selfless. And I don't know that Mitch McConnell was that selfless, because it was wearing him down. When he did that freezing up thing during the news conference last year, that was some scary stuff. If I saw a tape of myself looking like that with, what was his name, the guy that was standing next to him, Jim Thune, standing next to him and like basically holding on to his arm because nobody knew, was he going down, what's going on? He was just like blankly staring out into space, frozen. I see a videotape of myself like that, I get the doctor to write me a note and I'm going home. That's all. Does he really believe nobody from the state of Kentucky could represent the people except him? I think we should have a constitutional amendment that if you're going to run for office at a certain time after a certain age, whatever that age is, 80? I mean, if 70 is the new 50, maybe we'll have to make it 80. But if you're going to run for office after you're 80 years old, you should have to pass some serious tests, physical and mental competency tests. Because otherwise, there's always going to be a question. Not that I don't see some of these younger members of government that look dazed and confused to me. I'm not sure if they're just maybe, you know, California sober and smoking too much pot. I don't know. But some of them, they just don't look all there. But when you're 82 years old and you're staring blankly into space, I think that should be a sign that maybe it's time to go home, sit on your porch, you know, dictate a book to some ghostwriter. And, I don't know, enjoy your life. But apparently they just can't let go. Cannot let go of the power, cannot let go of the privilege. And that's so sad to me. So we'll see. We have a lot more to talk about. Elon Musk, as usual, has been very busy behind the scenes. And a lot of the things that he is busy doing are fascinating to me, because I don't think anybody can say he's not one of the smartest people in my lifetime. We don't have an Albert Einstein, but I think you'd have to say that Musk is a contender for smartest guy. You know, Newt Gingrich used to be one of the smartest guys in the room, but again, Newt Gingrich, you know, he's still very smart, but he's old. Sorry. And now we're getting these like doomsday warnings from Musk, which play right into talk radio's hands, that's for sure, and a lot of the media's hands. I mean, it's easier for us to talk about the end of the world than it is for us to talk about hope for the future when most people don't think there's much. So when he issues some of these warnings, people take it seriously. I mean, what did he say yesterday? That the whole of civilization is at stake. Okay. The whole of civilization. That's pretty all-inclusive, right? He said, the end times are approaching. Our whole civilization is at stake. And the only thing that could save it are people like him. Technology, and entrepreneurs like him are the only solution. And that's pretty amazing. It was a pretty chilling social media post. I don't know if you guys saw it. But he was on X, formerly known as Twitter. And usually he talks about how the population decline, people not having babies, is the biggest threat to this society. But now he's blaming something else altogether. He's saying you have to have people with different ideas, different companies doing different things. You can't have all these companies sharing the same ideology, the same agenda, the same people working for them, staffing and plan, because you're all going to get all the same outcomes. And I would have to agree with that. The stakes are high. How do we get out of this mess? Well, would you follow Elon Musk? That's my question. Don't forget, coming up after me is Eric Erickson, followed by Joe Pags and Lars Larson. And then we are going to wait until the morning when Jen and Bill come back with the South Florida Morning Show, followed at 9 by Brian Kilmeade and at noon by Dan Bongino, of course, with me back at 3. But I have one more segment left today. Stay right where you are. I'll be right back. We have a two-party system for the most part in this country. Whether we like to delude ourselves into thinking that a third party at some point could actually be more significant than it's been in the past. I mean, I watched Ross Perot and the Green Party and the this party and the that party, but we have a two-party system right now, except that it's more like a uniparty than anything I've ever seen. And I don't... I don't want to be affiliated with one half of this country, for the most part. It's not that I don't want to live in peace with them. I do. But I don't want anyone to, you know, mistakenly think that I believe that you can't tell the difference between a man and a woman. That's just too stupid. I don't want to be affiliated with people who think it's okay to cut healthy body parts off of young teens because they are confused and not sure if they were born in the... I don't want to be affiliated with people who believe that stuff because it's just... I think it's evil. I don't want to be affiliated with people who think that it's okay to beat somebody up because you don't agree with them or because they are oppressors in the minds of your identity group. What is all this nonsense? I don't want to be affiliated with any of it. Now, I'll live harmoniously with them, but don't confuse yourselves. These are not people that are anything like us or like me. I can only speak for myself. You know, where's the politics of the men and women who created this country? I don't think it's left, and I don't think it's far right. But the Democrat Party has gone so far off the reservation. They're corrupt to the point of insane. They're not even trying to hide the evil. They think it's okay to have these conversations about this gender nonsense. You know, that I have a Supreme Court justice who says she cannot define what a woman is. I just really, that's a problem for me. And they just keep traveling down this shameless path. It's full of corruption. It's full of deceit. How far will they go? And the more important question is, when do we figure out how to push back? Dare I say fight back? Can't even say fight. Somebody will say, oh, she's calling for this, that, and the other thing. No, I'm not. They've gone down this path. They use the most violent language. They say things about MAGA. And then they get all outraged if anybody on the right uses an expression just like the ones they use. And there are too many people who think the way we do, who think like I think, to be so cowed, to be so fearful that the masses are in opposition to your position. I don't know anybody. Literally, I don't know anybody, including people I know who have transgendered members in their family, transgendered friends, may even consider themselves, something other than male or female. But I just don't know a lot of them, and I don't think you do either, because I don't believe there are a lot of people that are still trying to figure out if it's a good idea to allow a 13-year-old to have a double mastectomy. I just don't know people who are that crazy. Maybe they're out there. I'm sure they're out there. I see it all the time on the news, but I don't know any. Even the most liberal people I know will tell you, well, I draw the line there, or I draw the line there. They're always drawing the line when I bring up the absurd. But it's getting too late. You know, you can't now draw the line after you've indulged the insanity for this long. You look at our neighboring country to the north, Canada, and I talk about the Canadian border in my No Restraint podcast this week because people along that border in Vermont and New York, and they're fed up with what's happening at the northern border. And it's not all political. It's quality of life that they're frustrated by. So when you see a leader like Justin Trudeau, who literally weaponizes the government of Canada to go after people who he doesn't agree with, and then you start to see it happening in our own country, wow. It's getting worse, not better. And that's why if people were at all concerned that a guy like Donald Trump could win an election in 2016 and then probably win another election in 2024, maybe they should have been a little more reasonable. Maybe they shouldn't have kept trying to get people to agree to doing unthinkable things and believing unbelievable things. Maybe they should have left our faith out of it, instead of going tooth and nail after people who profess a belief in God, whether it's Christians or Jews or even Muslims. They just don't want to hear it. And that has literally mobilized people of faith who would normally try and stay out of the whole political game and nonsense. But they can't anymore. They know that their culture is under a total threat of being annihilated, wiped out. And they're not willing to just allow that to happen. You know, saying you're pro-communist was kind of cutesy in the 60s and 70s, and you could wear your little Che Guevara t-shirt. But after looking at what has happened to human beings in countries where communism became the government, it's not so cutesy to wear the t-shirts anymore. In a country like America, where we have immigrants who have come in here legally or illegally, who have fled totalitarianism and communism and authoritarianism and all the rest of these nonsensical governments that just destroy cultures, the future actually hangs on this next election. Not just for us either. My friend Howard Galganoff said in his piece today, for Canada, even for countries that may not know it. This is a very, very pivotal moment in American history. It really is. I think it will go down in all of the history books as the moment when the American people said enough is enough, or when the American people failed to stop a leadership class of elites who stopped caring at all for what was in the best interests of the people and became so enamored of their own power that they said, screw the people, and then they proceeded to do that. Because there are plenty of people who feel that way, and it's not the NASCAR, you know, Bud Light drinking crowd that I'm talking about. It's people from all different parts of the country and all different socioeconomic backgrounds and all different race and ethnicities. They just look around and they say, wait a minute. Who said that this was okay with Black Americans or with Hispanic Americans? Who said this was okay with straight Americans? It's not. And what you end up with is a mobilized population, and you better hope that they're nonviolent. You know, I pray all the time that it will be a nonviolent movement in this country. Because when you look at some of these videotapes, my husband was talking this week in church about this videotape of this young girl, bashing the head of another young girl into the concrete and people just videotaping it. That's where we are. The level of violence, the level of disrespect. I mean, these flash mobs, which used to be cute because everybody, came to the mall and then broke into song. Well, now they break into stores and now they break heads. There is a real potential for something worse than we have ever imagined. And I'm one of these people that wants peace. I really do. But I'm not willing to give up freedom. You know, anybody who's willing to give up their freedom for peace won't have either. I wish I had made that up, but I didn't. The left has already made it clear. They showed us in 2020 that they will riot, they will burn, they will destroy, they'll even murder for political purposes. They've already declared that if Donald Trump was to win the White House in November of 2024, that they will not certify the election. So if anybody out there really believes that there's not going to be civil unrest whether Trump wins or loses, you're all by yourself. And it's time to face the music. We have to keep that from happening. But we also have to maintain our belief system, our culture, and our the sanctity of life. Because otherwise, I might as well just, I don't know where to go. There's nowhere to go. How about that? Anyway, don't forget, coming up after me is Eric Erickson, followed by Joe Pags and Lars Larson, the Overnight Guys, and then Jen and Bill will be back first thing in the morning at 6 a.m., followed by Brian Kilmeade at 9 and Dan Bongino at noon with me again at 3. But I still have one segment left today, so stay right where you are. I'll be right back.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast is being brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit CodeRedRoofers.com.